Good morning. So we're welcoming Judge Jeannie Cochran. She's now joined the panel. Judge Riley has left. And we're just taking a brief break, but remaining at the bench while the lawyers change places. And while the lawyers are getting ready, I will ask the marshal to call the second case on our calendar.
Now calling case number A22-0410, Masabi Metallics Company, LLC, et al. Appellants versus Minnesota Department of Natural Resources respondent.
All right, and good morning, counsel. You can just take your seat for a second and continue to unpack your materials, as I have just a few quick comments. Which you probably know already, but I'll say them anyway. So first of all, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We look forward to hearing your arguments today. We very much appreciate this opportunity to see you in person, having spent some time where we were unable to do so. So welcome. You are aware, I think, of our time parameters and our procedures. These proceedings are recorded. The audio recording will be available on the court's website. As a result, we ask you to do a couple of things. Identify yourself for the record before you start your remarks, as well as the client that you represent. And then please keep your eye on the clock. The 15 minutes tends to go quickly. We very much look forward to the conversation. So with that, counsel for appellant, we're ready for you.
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors. Brent Lawrence of Winthrop & Weinstein on behalf of appellants Masabi Metallics Company, Masabi Holdings LLC, and Masabi HBI. I will collectively refer to them as Masabi. We are here before the court today appealing an order by the district court in connection with a Rule 12.03 motion for judgment on the pleadings. From a big picture perspective, the district court effectively held as a matter of law without any discovery that a minor 3-week delay in a partial deposit of Masabi's own funds for Masabi's own benefit and which caused no harm or prejudice to the DNR justified the termination of a complex contract negotiated over 13 months, the concomitant termination of mineral leases going back many years and a relationship going back many years, and the forfeiture of Masabi's massive investment in the project to date. The district court should be reversed because it erred in at least 3 ways. First, the district court erred by incorrectly holding that the conditions precedent in Section 4 of the 2020 Master Lease Amendment were conditions precedent to contract formation, and effectively concluding that because those conditions were not satisfied by May 1, no contract between the parties were formed. This holding cannot be legally or logically reconciled with the undisputed fact that the 2020 Master Lease Amendment, at the time it was entered into in December of 2020, immediately imposed binding and enforceable obligations on the parties. It was not some unenforceable agreement to agree, nor was it merely an offer which could only be accepted in a particular way by a particular time. It was, in and of itself, a contract, offer, acceptance, consideration, and in fact, partial performance. Because it cannot reasonably be disputed that it was a binding and enforceable contract, the district court erred by effectively ruling that there was conditions precedent to formation of a contract and then dismissing the case on those grounds.
Counsel, in your view, can parties ever agree in writing to make formation of a contract subject to a condition precedent?
You can make the formation of the contract subject to a condition precedent, yes. And if the court would like, I can go into kind of how the law kind of looks at conditions precedent to formation of a contract versus conditions precedent to performance.
If you can do that, that would be helpful. I don't think there's any clear authority that I could find, precedential authority discussing the difference between a condition precedent to formation and a condition precedent to performance, Minnesota precedent, that is.
Yes.
So I that would help me, and it would, if you can address why the language in the amendment, I've read your brief and I'm familiar with your arguments, but if you can, kind of succinctly explain why the repeated language in the amendment that it does not become effective until certain conditions are met, the clear intent that it not become operative, why, without those conditions, why that isn't, why those conditions aren't conditions to formation of the contract.
Sure.
Given your recognition that you can have a condition precedent to formation in writing.
Sure. Let me take this piece by piece here. First, a condition precedent to the effectiveness of provisions of a contract, I do not believe, can reasonably or always be considered synonymous with a condition to formation of the contract. So take an oversimplified example. I could have a construction contract for the building of the house, and I could structure the contract to say that upon the payment of $50,000, you builder's obligation to build my house will become effective. I can enter into a contract and have provisions that will become effective upon the satisfaction of the condition precedent. And that's the distinction between performance and formation. As the district court noted in its order, there is a distinction in the law between conditions precedent to formation and conditions precedent to performance. This was reflected in the Starlight Limited Partnership case cited by the district court. There, the Starlight case stated, the law governing contract formation is distinct from that of contract performance. The Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized that distinction in that stating that because of strict rules governing offer and acceptance, which require that an acceptance be in the terms of the offer, we are reluctant to follow by analogy rules laid down with respect to contracts already formed. In passing upon questions of offer and acceptance, courts may wisely require greater exactitude when they are trying to salvage the existing contract. Similarly, the Minnesota Supreme Court stated in the Massey case that one may condition his entry into contract relations as he sees fit, resorting even to absurdity if he chooses. So although there be complete agreement on terms, if one expresses the intention not to be bound until the signing of a formal contract, there is no contract if that condition is not fulfilled. Until it is filled, the matter remains in negotiation and may be withdrawn. Here is the key point. If you have a contract, you have a contract. If you do not have a contract, you do not have a contract. You cannot have conditions precedent to formation of a contract if it is undisputed that the contract the parties have agreed to already contains legally enforceable and binding obligations. And that's the case with respect to the 2020 Master Lease Amendment. It did, in fact, contain immediately binding and enforceable obligations. Therefore, there can be no dispute that a contract was actually formed. We can argue about which provisions of that formed contract are effective and under which provisions the parties are obligated to perform, but we cannot dispute that there is a contract. Let me talk a bit about the obligations that were immediately binding on the parties.
So, counsel, here's what I struggle with. You make the logical statement that a contract provision that limits effectiveness of the contract to a condition precedent isn't necessarily the same as a condition precedent to contract formation. And I track that as a general proposition. But when I drill down to the specific contract language in the 2020 contract, it says, and I'm quoting, I hope I'm accurate, some but not all of the conditions precedent to the effectiveness of the 2020 amendment, if Mesabi satisfies some but not all of the conditions precedent to the effectiveness of the 2020 amendment, and this is one of them that's identified for effectiveness, the 2020 amendment shall not become effective. I mean, it seems that it was in the party's contemplation by this language that this particular condition precedent was a condition precedent to formation of the contract. Based on that, the way the contract itself discusses effectiveness. And I think that's the district court's analysis, and I'm just struggling with why I shouldn't agree with it. So,
the language, the 2020 amendment shall not become effective in conditions 4, cannot possibly mean that the entire contract has no legal or binding.
So the parties didn't mean what they said, because that's what it says.
I will say that it was inartful language, but...
Well, counsel, you know what a position that puts us in as a court. I mean, telling the parties that they didn't really mean what they said, when nobody's telling us the language is ambiguous, or at least I didn't see that in your brief. Maybe I missed that. Help me out.
Again, yeah. If there are legal and binding obligations in the contract, there cannot be a condition precedent to formation of the contract. And if the 2020 amendment has not become effective at all as a result of the failure of the condition precedent, the minor noncompliance of the condition precedent in Section 4, then the DNR cannot have its Section 23 extended termination right, and the DNR cannot rely on its rights set forth in the contract to maintain the $25 million that were provided to the various state agencies as part of the other conditions precedent, as part of satisfaction of the other conditions precedent. You can't have a contract that gives some rights to parties, but is not a contract for other purposes. The existence of a contract is a binary proposition, and once it is established that a contract exists, the condition precedent must necessarily be a condition precedent to performance and not a condition precedent to formation. And when you get to the point of it being a condition precedent to performance, you bring in the protections that are afforded to parties to a contract. And that includes the ability to consider the DNR's compliance with its own contractual obligations under Section 29, as well as the materiality and forfeiture analyses called for by Trolin and Capistrano. And so either there is a contract or there is not. And if there is a contract...
Just assuming for purposes of argument that we agree with you, because clearly, you know, we haven't made a decision in this case. But let's talk about the Capistrano case.
Sure.
The court in that case, our Supreme Court recognized that our precedent reflects a general rule that conditions must be literally met or exactly fulfilled, or no liability can arise on the promise qualified by the condition. And the court then went on to say, apply Section 229 of the restatement in this unique context of the case, the facts in that case. And I don't see language in the Capistrano case saying that Section 229 applies in all cases where there's a dispute about a condition precedent. In fact, it doesn't, you know, expressly, you know, overrule the prior decisions applying the general rule.
Certainly, and let me offer a couple observations here. The Capistrano court did reference the unique context of that case in applying Section 229, and its conclusion was that the unique context here justifies its application. What the Supreme Court did not do is expressly limit Capistrano's application to the unique facts of that case. In fact, what the Supreme Court said in footnote 3 was, we don't have to decide that issue, we're not being asked to decide that issue, but we do note that this Section 229 analysis has been applied in all sorts of other contexts that are not at issue in our present case. So I think the logical reading of Capistrano in that case is that it recognized that unique context was appropriate. It did not limit it to that unique context. And that brings me to the issue relating to the procedural posture at which this case was dismissed. It was dismissed on the pleadings without any opportunity for discovery and without any opportunity to prepare a fact record which would allow us to demonstrate the unique context of this case. And this case is incredibly unique. You have a long-lasting relationship involving real estate rights covering thousands of acres, a relationship that has been subject to leases existing for many years that have been amended in the past. You have an effort between the parties to maintain that relationship, and you have the possibility that a party will lose hundreds of millions of dollars if the project is canceled or forfeit. And so this is certainly a unique context where the parties should be allowed to develop the fact record and demonstrate why the May 1 date was not material to the overarching negotiations here, and to also demonstrate why the results of strictly applying that May 1 date would constitute a disproportionate forfeiture.
Isn't it this case distinguishable from Capistrano, though, because here we have a situation where Mesabi was in default and this amendment was designed to address that default and had my math might be wrong, but a 5-month period to from when it was signed to the May 1st date. There was a clear drop-dead date there, which is that we're not in a, you know, the amendment is separate from the prior agreements, and so we're not in a situation where someone's been relying on a contract that's been in existence for a number of years, like in Capistrano.
I think I would agree that, yes, the facts are different from what exists in Capistrano to the extent that there was a, you know, that was an employment relationship. This is certainly different. But I think the overarching principle to be taken from Capistrano is that the application of the 229 analysis is a factually intensive inquiry, both in determining whether it should be applied and in then actually applying it. And the district court deprived Mesabi of its opportunity by dismissing this case on the pleadings.
So going back to the first issue, just briefly, given your time, and you might want to address this later, I also recognize that Minnesota law isn't clear or detailed on contract formation where it's subject to a condition precedent. So would it be helpful for this court to issue a precedential decision on the issue that you've raised, in particular as to that first issue?
I think it would be, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Oliver Larson. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. My client is the Department of Natural Resources, who is the respondent in this matter. I want to begin really by just bringing some focus to the structure and text of Section 4 of the 2020 Amendment. And that's, you know, the key provision here, the provision that lays out the conditions preceding to the effectiveness of the agreement. And if you look at it, you know, it has in the middle of Section 4 there, sort of lettered A through G, the conditions preceding that have to be satisfied. But just as importantly, at the beginning of Section 4 and at the end of Section 4, there's three paragraphs, one at the top, two at the bottom, that lay out in explicit detail the unambiguous agreement that was reached between the DNR and Mesabi on two critical issues. They reached agreement on the issue of what would happen if there was a partial satisfaction of the conditions preceding, and they reached an explicit agreement on what DNR's termination rights would be in the event that there wasn't an effective 2020 amendment. So if you look at the bottom of Section 4, that's where they address the partial satisfaction. It's the language that Judge Bratfold read for us, in which the parties explicitly agreed if Mesabi and SR Global achieve some but not all of the conditions preceding, the effect of that will be that the 2020 amendment is not effective and the parties will operate under the existing leases as amended by the prior bankruptcy amendments.
So, counsel, does that mean then that the DNR, the language that gives the DNR the right to terminate the leases if the conditions are not satisfied, that that doesn't become effective either?
No, there is an agreement within the agreement, right? The parties had a conundrum. What was happening in December of 2020, the issue that the parties were confronted with is that DNR had the right to terminate the leases. But it was a time-limited right. Essentially, the way that this that the leases were written is it said, once there was a material default, DNR would have 1 year in which to terminate the leases. So that 1 year was going to come due on December 31st, 2020. So DNR and Mesabi are entering into the 2020 amendment, conditional agreement on December 4th of 2020. And they have the following conundrum. Within 30 days, the DNR's right to terminate the leases for that provision is going to go away by the terms of the prior agreement, but the parties want to afford Mesabi 6 months from December 4th to May 1st to try and get its house in order and move this forward. So they reached this just basically a standstill agreement. DNR agrees we won't exercise our right to terminate. Mesabi agrees, okay, if we don't get our ducks in a row and May 1st comes and we haven't done what we're supposed to do, you can go ahead and exercise that right that you already have. So that's the only part of this provision, of this agreement that really came into effect. And one of the things that Mesabi is telling you is there was all these things at the beginning of the contract, obligations that were put on the parties. The only obligation that was put on DNR was do not terminate. That was the only obligation DNR took on in the 2020 amendment, not terminate for 6 months. And at the top of Section 4, we see an explicit agreement between the parties about what was going to happen on May 2nd if Mesabi showed up with $100 million in its bank account instead of $200 million. The parties explicitly agreed DNR would have the right to terminate. That's the explicit, unambiguous agreement they reached.
So then are you agreeing that the contract was formed when it was signed?
I think one of the issues that we've got here, and let me take a step back. I do encourage you to read into, I think it's page 21 of our brief, where we cite some of the case law, but also the Williston. And I know I don't normally like to cite the treatises, but the Williston treatise here is very good. It kind of lays out in summary fashion how we treat the differences between contract, conditions preceding to formation, conditions preceding to performance, that they are different things. And there's not much case law in Minnesota simply because there hasn't been much reason to litigate this issue in the past because Capistrano's a fairly new decision. So you can have conditions preceding to formation in a contract that is already formed. Indeed, if you want to, you can write a contract that says everything's effective, but if something happens in the future, the contract becomes ineffective and is a nullity. These are, you know, sophisticated commercial parties are allowed to enter into contracts like that. And the inquiry isn't one of semantics, right? I think that's the inquiry that Mesabi wants to get you, that it's just semantics. Once the contract is inked,
I think the argument's a little bit more sophisticated than that. They're saying that it's binary. You know, there either is a contract or there isn't a contract. You're asking us to parse it out. I mean, I'm just jotting some of your language. It's things like this, that there's a contract within a contract is one phrase that you use. So you are rejecting their premise. You're saying, nope, you can have a contract within a contract. And here, that's, I think, what you're saying happened in 2020. And it's actually more than just one, right? There were multiple contracts, weren't there, between the DNR and Mesabi?
In the past, yes.
Yeah, in the past.
Prior to
over,
2020,
over
yes.
This period of time.
Yeah. Well, so let me put it this way. If you read into the case law about contracts or conditions preceding and what you're supposed to do with them, you're supposed to do with them what you do with every contract provision, right? What's the intent of the parties? And so there isn't a binary world in which because there's ink on a contract, the contracts form and nothing can be a contract condition preceding to contract formation. And that's the International Brotherhood, the California case we cited you. Of course, you can sign a contract that's fully inked, binding on the parties, but nonetheless still says this won't become effective or portions of this won't become effective if certain conditions preceding aren't met. And when courts encounter that language, conditions preceding to effectiveness, they do not engage in materiality analysis. Because the idea is you'll be putting parties into a contract they didn't agree to enter into. That's fundamentally the issue we have here, right? There is no doubt. Let me take a step back. Look at the context of this, right? There was a default. There have been 2 years in which Mesabi had been given to complete the Taconite pellet plant. It failed miserably. We're sitting there. They need another 2 years to complete it. They don't even have their financing lined up in December of 2020 to do this. There's no doubt about what the DNR agreed to. DNR said, we do not want to be in a new contract with you unless you satisfy the following conditions, A through G. If you do that, we have a new contract. If you don't, we don't have a contract. There is no doubt that that is what the intent of the parties were. And unless this court's going to say that parties can't agree to contracts like that, and then any situation in which we're like that, we're going to have to get into materiality analysis. Anytime a party wants to plead that, you know, that condition preceding wasn't material, I think we're going to really lose something. I mean, especially in this case, right? Because we're talking about two parties that are in default and a novation settlement agreement, right? This is probably one of the most common ways that parties try to resolve their disputes. You got a party that's got a contract that's in default. The counterparty doesn't want to enter into a new contract, but is willing to do it if certain conditions preceding are met. And that's exactly how they structure it. They say, as a condition preceding to this new agreement to cure your defaults and let you try to move forward, here's what I'm willing to do. New contract for you if you can meet these conditions preceding. If this court is going to say that parties that reach that agreement are nonetheless going to get tied up in years of litigation and discovery about the materiality of those conditions preceding, and whether in their heart of hearts they really meant it when they said, you really do need to get $200 million into a bank account by May 1st, that I think what you're going to see, one of the impacts you're going to see, is parties unwilling to enter into these kinds of innovation settlement agreements. I mean, that's going to be the impact of this, is that you can't achieve the finality. And why would DNR have given up the right in December to terminate the leases, to enter into a contract that would then require to then litigate the basis for termination? These are the reasons why parties use conditions preceding to effectiveness in these kinds of agreements.
So for a condition precedent to formation, I did a fair amount of research, and it seems to me in a number of cases where from other jurisdictions where that's been recognized, it's generally contingent on an event that isn't really within the control of the parties.
Yes and no. I think it is very common, but I will tell you, I'm a commercial litigator by trade, and so, business asset sale agreements are littered with these kinds of agreements. Like, two businesses get together, they're going to have a very complex transaction where one party is going to sell a business to another, to another business. And those contracts are going to be full of conditions preceding to effectiveness around issues like due diligence, environmental liabilities, all kinds of things that have to happen for the agreement to finally close. But nonetheless, what they want is clarity at the beginning of their relationships. They have a signed contract that lays out in explicit detail, okay, assuming the following things happen, we're going to have an effective sale agreement, and here's what we need to do. So it's not just things outside of the control. It can be things within the party's control as well.
So it's your view that even though the action that was required to be taken was required performance by Mesabi, that it wasn't a condition precedent for performance. It was a condition precedent to formation, because of the effectiveness language throughout the agreement.
Correct. I don't want to get into the semantics of it. Whether we call it conditions preceding to formation or conditions preceding to effectiveness, the idea is that there's a distinction between saying a condition preceding to performance is really one where everyone agrees, there's contracts, the parties are bound to one another, but one party's performance is not due until some other performance is delivered. That's a condition preceding to performance. When the parties are saying, we don't have a contract unless this condition is satisfied, that's a condition preceding to formation, and it can be explicit and it can be in writing. And Judge Cochran, just give you another example. One of the most common conditions preceding to the effectiveness of an agreement is a financing contingency, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's a sale of a house or a business or anything else, somebody's saying, like, I'm going to have to go out and line up the financing to consummate this transaction, and that's a condition preceding to the effectiveness of our agreement. I'm not obligated to buy your house, or I'm not obligated to buy your business if I can't find the financing. And of course, part of that's within the control of the party, and part of it may not be, right, if they can't find a bank willing to do it. But these conditions can very much be within the control of a party and still be a condition preceding to formation, the idea being that there is no contract if it's not satisfied. That's the key.
So in your view, portions of the contract were formed when the contract was signed, but other portions were not?
It's a hybrid agreement. There is no doubt. I'm not going to run away from the idea that there was within the 2020 amendment, there was this other agreement that was reached on this one issue of maintaining a default rate. I will also note, by the way, even if that got read out, the result in this case would be the same, because Mesabi ended up not completing a whole bunch of other items of performance, so DNR would have been able to terminate the lease no matter what. So it didn't actually need to preserve this right, but it did. They agree to a standstill agreement. That's really all it is. And it'd be equivalent, like in a business sale agreement, one of the things that the seller of a business usually agrees to do when it enters into one of these contracts is to stop marketing his business, right? It says, okay, I agree, I'm going to sell my business to you, you're going to do some due diligence, you're going to do a bunch of things, and I agree in this interim period, I'm going to stop trying to sell the business to somebody else. Very common provision in a business asset sale agreement. We wouldn't say that that converts all of the conditions preceding to effectiveness into conditions preceding to the performance of the contract. I mean, what was the intent of the parties here? I think it's the central question. If the party's intent was that there would be no contract on May 2nd if the conditions preceding weren't met, then those are conditions preceding to formation and should be analyzed under the law basically of offer and acceptance rather than the materiality standard of a material breach. One issue I did want to get into very briefly, because it came up in the reply and I didn't have a chance to address it, is the trolling case. So obviously a lot of reliance placed by Mesabi on the trolling case. And then we distinguish it in our response brief. This is the case where there had been a lease and it allowed the tenant essentially to extend the lease if it provided a notice to the city saying, I want to extend my lease for another 5 years. And it gave the notice late, and the question is, well, is it, you know, what happens? It gave the notice late. And the court in that case said, late notice provision in a real estate contract, we're not going to strictly enforce that. And so Misabi's relying on that in this case. Capistrant distinguished that, right? The issue came up in Capistrant. Capistrant said, no, look, that's a notice provision in a real estate contract. We're limiting that principle of law to those situations, notice provisions in a real estate contract. In the reply brief, Misabi comes back and says, well, this is real estate matter, which, you know, we can argue about that, but let's take it that this is a real estate contract because it's a lease for minerals. It's still not a notice provision, right? That's the key here. The trolling court is saying if it's just a notice provision, if you can extend your lease by just sending a notice to your landlord saying, I want to extend my lease, that's very different than an item of performance that you have to deliver. And that's the basis on which Capistrant distinguished trolling and said, look, if you have to deliver performance, if you have to do something to satisfy the condition precedent, it's not a notice provision, trolling doesn't apply. So in this case, you know, they had to do more than just tell DNR they wanted the leases. They had to get $200 million into a bank account. They didn't. Trolling doesn't apply.
Can you speak to Capistrant and what guidance we are to take from that as to when Section 229 applies as opposed to the general?
Yes, and I do think the court should publish its opinion on this because we need to put some more meat on the bones of Capistrant, right? I think when you read Capistrant, I think the word unique has to mean something. The court is saying in this unique case, we're going to apply Section 229. It doesn't overrule the body of case law that came before it that said, in general, strict enforcement of conditions precedent is the rule of law. And so I think there's any number of ways in which you can look at Capistrant and distinguish it. On a legal basis, I think, frankly, the most effective way you can distinguish Capistrant is on this distinction between conditions precedent to performance and conditions precedent to formation, right? There's a body of case law around it from other jurisdictions that people can rely on. It's a well-understood concept that if the condition goes to the effectiveness of the entire agreement, that's different than an item of performance. So that's one basis. I think the other basis, you could just look at this and say, look, Capistrant was a case in which the parties had performed for 28 years and the condition came at the end, very different than this case in which we've got a condition preceding at the very beginning of the formation and a default. I see I'm out of time.
So, counsel, I'll give myself a little time with you. And I just want to follow up briefly on your comment that we should issue a precedential decision as to 229. It seems to me your comments recognize that that would also touch on the first issue as to conditions precedent formation as well as conditions precedent to effectiveness.
Yeah, I think however this court handles the Capistrant case, they should issue a precedential decision because I can just tell you that sophisticated commercial counsel are going to be looking at this case wondering, you know, how do they do these kinds of contracts? When is materiality going to be an issue and when is it not? And so I think the court can give guidance on that.
And just one more question. So it sounds to me like you also think that the best authority for viewing this contract as, and one of the words you used was a contract within a contract, so some contract provisions in the 2020 agreement were effective and binding, some were not until conditions precedent came into play. So that is the California case, Teamsters decision. You think
that's right.
Most closely parallel?
I think it's on point for the idea that you can sign a contract and still have conditions precedent to contract effectiveness or contract formation.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points, and I'd like to start with the Teamsters case since that was part of the discussion that just finished. Mm-hmm. The Teamster case supports the proposition that we are arguing to the court that the formation of the contract is an all or nothing proposition. That was a situation where the parties had signed the contract in advance of a approval from, I believe, a city council and had said that the contract in its entirety will not be binding unless the city council later approves it. And that is what happened in that case. The entire point of the court's analysis was to evaluate whether or not there was anything in that contract that became binding prior to the city approval, which led to the discussion of whether or not it was a condition precedent to formation or a condition precedent to performance.
Are you aware of any case involving a hybrid situation as counsel for respondent referred to, or a contract within a contract?
I am not, Your Honor, and the way I take it down is I just back it up to the guiding principles of offer, acceptance, consideration for contract formation, and then look at the conditions precedent to performance. And I will say this, I mean, the term condition precedent is not a term of art that is more often than not intended to be applied to conditions to formation. In fact, it's quite the opposite. When parties refer to conditions precedent, it is most commonly in the context of a condition precedent to performance. The last point I would like to make is to perhaps clarify, we are not arguing about the materiality of the substance of the conditions. What we are arguing about is the materiality of the May 1 date for the satisfaction of those conditions.
But can you really separate that? I mean, wasn't the obligation to provide that amount of money by that date?
Your Honor, if I may, Section 4 of the agreement, when it refers to the May 1 date, specifically says right before it, unless a different date is specified. It explicitly leaves open the possibility of the parties agreeing in good faith and in commercially reasonable means to another date. The other point I wanted to raise...
Just going back to that point, though, isn't that the other... I lost the where the other date specified language is. But in Section 4, there is 4B has a December 1st, 2020 date as opposed to the May 1, 2021. So isn't that reference to another date referring to the December 1st date in B, C, and D?
I think that is one reasonable interpretation of that. I do not think it is the only reasonable interpretation of that. And let me add why. One of the provisions of this contract that has gotten extremely short shrift, it was entirely ignored by the district court, and it was largely glossed over by the DNR, and that's Section 29 of the agreement. And let me just read this incredibly broad language to the court. Section 29. Each of the parties agrees to use commercially reasonable efforts to take or cause to be taken all appropriate action and to do or cause to be done all things necessary to fully reflect, consummate, perform, and make effective the terms and provisions of this 2020 amendment, including, without limitation, using their respective commercially reasonable efforts to obtain all consents, approvals, or authorizations necessary to fully reflect, consummate, perform, and make effective the terms and provisions of this 2020 amendment, and perform and fulfill all obligations and conditions precedent within such parties' control pursuant to this 2020 amendment. The parties did not negotiate for sharp practices or strict application of immaterial deadlines. This is a contract covering thousands of acres of real estate upon which parties will rely on investing hundreds of millions of dollars. The parties reasonably contracted for commercial reasonableness as a concept covering the entirety of the relationship. This is not a case where they could have said in the contract, if you don't meet the conditions precedent by the May 1 date, you acknowledge that this date is material for reasons A, B, and C, and you acknowledge that the outcome of that is not going to be a disproportionate forfeiture. There are all sorts of ways this contract could have been drafted to create the sharp result that the DNR wants here. And I can tell you that such a sharp contract certainly would not have included Section 29. I will also add with respect to Section 23, which is the termination provision that gives the DNR the right to terminate a year after approval, that extended the DNR's right to December of 2021. During the negotiations of that, and this is in our addendum, there was an email from Mr. Larson saying that he added Section 23, it was intended to be beneficial to both parties, and it was intended to provide a window for Mesabi to close out the conditions precedent. The conditions precedent were due by May 1, 2021. The extension of the termination right went an additional 7 months beyond that. If the parties truly intended for that May 1 date to be the date by which the fates were cast, there would have been no reason to extend it beyond that, and there would have been no reason for Mr. Larson's representation. Thank you.
Any further questions from the panel? Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both lawyers in this case. We really appreciate hearing from you today. The oral arguments were very helpful. This matter is now submitted to the court for decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So that concludes the second oral argument matter on our calendar. That concludes all of our oral arguments scheduled for today. So this court will now be in recess for its non-oral conference. Thank you.